Hey, good morning, everybody. Welcome to school. This is Bio 231, and it is April 27th. And if we need to finish anything up on the heart chapter, we're going to do that today and then move on to the vascular chapter. So I think I do want to draw a couple things on the board that will help you with the heart, especially in lab. And here's a really nice, simple way to think of the heart. And probably I would like you to draw this out. That will help you remember all these little details. So go ahead and start to draw this out. So if you're going to think of a shape that describes the heart, would it be a square, a rectangle, an oval, a circle, or what?
Triangle.
A triangle. Fantastic. And or maybe a pyramid because it's a three-dimensional object. But if you say, since this board is flat, we're just going to say a triangle. All right, so here is, there's only three things you got to know to get started on the heart. Three things. Oh, a nice dark marker. So we're going to draw a triangle, and the widest part is going to be facing which way? It's going to be on the top, yeah. So it's a little bit different than a regular pyramid. All right, so we're going to look at something like that. So the three things. Number one, you have to know what that pointy end is called. That is apex. Is that hard to find on a heart? No, that's easy to find. Apex. Because when you look at a real heart today or on Wednesday in lab, it's just going to look like a blob to you, right? Until you get some of these landmarks and then it will hit you and say, oh, well, it's not very hard at all to understand what's going on in the heart. All right, so number one is apex. And number two is this part of the heart. What do we call that? Yeah, that's going to be like the base of the pyramid. But it's on top. But nonetheless, we're going to call this the base. So there are great vessels that lead the heart from the base, right from the base of the heart. Great vessels at the base of the heart. And then one last thing that you really have to be educated about, but once you see it a couple times, it will be easy, and then the whole heart is going to make sense. There is a depression. What do we call a depression in anatomy? A sulcus. Yeah, it's a sulcus. And there are some coronary blood vessels that move through that sulcus, and a depression never goes to waste. Any extra room in that sulcus is filled with fat. Right? So the muscle of the heart is going to be nice dark red, and the fat is going to be white, so you're going to have this nice white stripe or yellow stripe on the heart. And as you go from base to apex, it doesn't go straight down. It curves around the heart like this on a diagonal. And that is the third thing. That's the only coronary blood vessel, only sulcus, that kind of wraps around the heart like a stripe on a candy cane. Okay, all the rest comes straight down. And this is what we're going to call the longitudinal. Sorry, my word is kind of sagging there. And longitudinal and its anterior sulcus. And actually both people say anterior longitudinal sulcus. So when you're looking at this heart right there that I drew on the board, it's like looking at my heart. Right? Same orientation. So what side of the heart is this over here? That's right. So here's the left side. And then over here is the right side. All right, so if you just know these three things, you know what the right and left side is, you know the top and the bottom. If you know this is anterior, you know what's posterior. All that kind of stuff. So with just these three things, you learn a lot about the heart. Okay, and then of course you should know that the heart has how many chambers? Four, yeah. Two atria near the base, and then two ventricles near the apex. And the ventricles are the strong chambers that pump blood to your circulations. All right, well, when we get into, well, we talked about it, I think, already. All right, we said that there are four chambers. Four valves, right? There's a valve between an atrium and a ventricle in both locations, the tricuspid and bicuspid. And then there's a valve at the base of the great arteries that lead the heart. Anybody remember what the blood vessel is that leads the right ventricle? It is the pulmonary trunk or pulmonary artery. It's going to lead the right ventricle. And then over here is, you're all familiar with this one, this is the aorta that's going to leave the left ventricle. Okay. There's a reason why I wanted to go over that, but I forgot what it was. Oh well, it might come back to me. All right, so that's these three things for lab are really important. Ah, this little stripe right here you can see from across the room, like a male and female pelvis. So if you freak out during the practical exam and say, oh, this heart just looks like just a blob to me, okay, find these three things and I'm sure everything will just snap back into your memory. Because that has happened before. Students raise their hand during a practicum and said, wow, I knew everything about the heart model, the real heart, and I'm looking at the real heart and I can't recognize anything. And then I say, okay, just answer these three questions for me, but don't say it out loud. Just say the name, just answer these questions in your mind. And I go, do you see the apex? And they kind of nod their head. And I say, do you see the base? And they kind of nod their head. And then I say, do you see the anterior longitudinal sulcus? And then all of a sudden, they don't nod their head anymore. They just go, oh. Okay, so those three things, everything should snap into place for you. All right, if we look, oh, this is what I wanted to say. All right, so there's a right side and a left side. So there's four chambers, four valves. How many sides?
Two,
right? So right and left is the best way to think of that. So there are how many major circulations in your body? There are two, right? Because there's a right and left side. So your heart is actually like two hearts. There's one on the right, there's one on the left, and each pump blood to a particular circulation in your body. And we're going to look at that in just a second. One is the pulmonary, and the other circulation is the systemic circulation. That's why the heart has two sides. All right, let's look down from a superior view, looking down on top of the base. And I think this might help you quite a bit. So it's just going to kind of look like a circle, like so. Then here is anterior. Here's posterior. And I want you to see what the relationship is to of the great vessels coming off the base of the heart. If you're going to draw them in, right, where would you draw them in? On the base of the heart. And there are four of them that I want you to know. So let's talk about the arteries first. There's the pulmonary artery or pulmonary trunk and the aorta. Those are the arteries. The veins, right, is going to be the vena cava and the pulmonary veins. Right, so I just want to quickly draw them in just as a little concept map, and that is a really good art figure. Right, so here is, what side of the heart is this? Anterior. There is a vessel that's very large, and it's the most anterior vessel coming off the base of the heart. And this is going to be the pulmonary trunk. I guess I can fit it in right here. And where does this blood vessel go if we say pulmonary? It goes to the lungs, right? Okay, pulmonary trunk. And you should know that the trunk is what, a capillary, an artery, or a vein? It's an artery. Yeah, so I'm just going to put this down here. It's an artery. Okay, now it's going to look really big and thick and strong, okay? But the biggest and thickest one is going to be right behind it. It's going to be like this, all right? And this is going to be the aorta. That's going to take blood to your systemic circulation. And then posterior to the aorta, right about here, is going to be the superior vena cava, which means the big cavernous vein on the top draining blood from your head back down to your heart. All right, so these are the three that I really want you to know, because when we start doing a dissection, you're going to run into a big, thick blood vessel. We're going to do a nice anterior cut right through the sternum of our fetal pig and dissect down to the heart. And what blood vessel are you going to see first? And it's going to trick you because it's a big, strong artery. It's going to look like a big, strong artery. And it is, but which one is it? Pulmonary. Yeah, it's the pulmonary, right? Because you're going to come in from this direction, and which is the first one you're going to find? Pulmonary trunk. And in order to find the aorta, what do you have to do? You're going to have to dig a lot deeper to find the aorta. Right? So even when you look at the pig hearts in lab, right? Make sure that you see that that's the pulmonary trunk. Pulmonary trunk and aorta are going to look almost the same, but they're going to look a lot different than the superior vena cava. So I mention this because a lot of students might switch these two, might switch the pulmonary and the aorta. But just remember that the aorta is the most anterior one. Okay, so that will help you in lab. Now, I didn't go over the schedule. Sorry, let's go back to the schedule. Today's the 27th. We're going to get into blood vessels today. We talked a little bit about some blood vessels with regard to the heart. And then 1, 2, 3.5 weeks from today is your last exam. And here you can see the chapters. It's not cumulative, but it's going to cover all these chapters. These chapters are pretty short, so they're not long like the nervous system chapters. And also that last week, there are practicums, the fourth practicum. The Monday labs get a practicum, but not a lecture exam. But the Wednesday labs, they get a practicum and a lecture exam on the same day. So I can't remember who's in Wednesday in particular. So just be prepared with that. And you should be working extensively with your study guides already, right? Because as you know by now, you can't cram in this class. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody got a question over the schedule? I think we're pretty good. All right, I'll put that away. And I want to pull up something maybe I forgot about. I'll turn the lights down maybe in just a second. We looked at the anatomy of cells of the myocardium, but I don't talk about it much in this lecture, but there's a couple questions at the end of the chapter and online questions regarding the structure of cardiac muscle cells. All right, so I see some cardiac muscle cells, and then I even see some connective tissue in here. How are you going to describe to me a cardiac muscle cell that I have on this slide?
Branch.
Ah, branch. I see. Oh, look at this nice big branch right here. Look at this branch right here. Yes, they are branched, unlike muscle fibers. Remember, a muscle fiber is a skeletal muscle, long and linear, no branching. But how are you going to try to convince me that this is, I see that branching pattern, how are you going to convince me that it's any kind of muscle? Nice, the striations, right? The striations are a result of that machine for contraction, which is a sarcomere, right? The structural and functional unit of contraction is a sarcomere. It just repeats itself over and over and over again. Okay, now what about the length of these cells? Are they long like a skeletal muscle? No, they're not. They're short. Right, so I see one going from here right to here, and then a little branching pattern or to here. So they're very short, so you can see the whole extent of a single cell. And every cell has only one nucleus because it's a small cell. All right, so these cells, remember, they're specialized to do what? What are these cells specialized to do? Yeah, contract, right? They develop tension. So this cell on the right is going to pull away from the cell on the left, and when that happens, it could just rip these cells apart, and then you would have a hole in what organ? Your heart, right? Which would be horrible because blood would just come gushing out if you had a hole in your heart. So what's the special thing that glues these cells together? Yeah, that intercalated disc, right? So I can see it very nicely on this micrograph. Sometimes it's lab, depending on how you focus it and adjust the light. Sometimes it's tough. All right, so that intercalated disc has two important features to it. It has these adherens junctions, right, which attach the neighboring cells together so that they don't pull apart. And it also has a gap junction. And you can see a gap junction looks like a tunnel or a channel. And you should tell me what the function of a gap junction is. What's the function of a gap junction within the intercalated disc? I heard a pretty good explanation is that it's a special way that these cells can communicate with each other, right? This top cell in the illustration and the bottom cell. And the kind of communication that these cells share is electrical information. So if this top cell becomes excited, right, and that happens before contraction, then what happens to the bottom cell? Then it gets excited and it starts to contract as well. So all of these intercalated discs all right, allow for that excitation to move from one cell to another, not only from right to left, but because of the special pattern of branching, how else does that electrical signal go? From top to bottom across the whole wall of the heart. We call that the transmural wall of the heart, all the way across. That wouldn't happen if it was a skeletal muscle. All right, so just remember the special kind of structure of myocardial cells. Right, but they're still striated. Okay, in your pre-lecture reading assignments, well, maybe did I go over this? Maybe there's just a couple of things. I went over the conduction system of the heart last time. Okay, and did I not do that? Oh, wow, okay, let's look at the conduction system of the heart because there's some really nice special things about it. And here it is right here. All right. Actually, I can just skip down. Here's a really nice illustration of that cardiac muscle cell. You can see it's short. You can see its branch. You can see myofibrils and sarcomeres in it, pretty much just like a skeletal muscle. And here's just a nice electron micrograph, which we don't have to look at. All right, so here is, all right, a really nice illustration of the conduction system of the heart. So mostly the heart is made out of muscle that contracts. But there are some muscle cells that are specialized for transmitting electrical information, right? And we call that part of the conduction system of the heart. So here are the pieces of the conduction system. I want you to start up over here on the superior right side of the heart. Here are some cells that are autorhythmic. They can excite themselves. Right, and they can change the rhythm of how frequently they can excite and send information throughout the rest of the heart. This is called the sinoatrial node, SA node for short. And this is what we call the pacemaker, right? Because as soon as these cells get excited, what happens? That electrical information flows over the whole heart through what kind of thing? The gap junction, right? It's included in the intercalated discs. All right, so this SA node gets excited. We call that depolarization. That initiates contraction, right? And then the electrical signal comes down to this space between the atria and the ventricles. And remember, last time I talked about the fibrous skeleton of the heart. There is a connective tissue layer that separates the atria from the ventricles, and that electrical signal can't get through the connective tissue because it's not nervous tissue and it's not muscle tissue. So here is a special structure that allows that electrical signal from the atria to get down into the ventricles, and this right here is called the AV node, atrioventricular node, right? Because it's right between an atrium and a ventricle. And this is the only way electrical signals can get from the atria into the ventricles. And then the AV node passes information to the atrioventricular bundle, right through here. And in these two structures, that electrical signal is delayed a little bit. Right, so the AV node, AV bundle holds on to that signal before it releases the signal down into the bundle branches that I see right here, and then finally into Purkinje fibers. And it's the Purkinje fibers that spread that electrical excitation to all of the muscle fibers that make up the ventricles. All right, so Purkinje fibers excite these cardiac muscle cells, and Purkinje fibers get their information from the bundle branches. Bundle branch gets it from the AV bundle, and the AV bundle gets it from the AV node. AV node is stimulated by the SA node. Okay, so it goes like that. All right, so because there's a delay between the AV node and these Purkinje fibers down over here, both atria contract together, followed by the ventricles. All right, so the ventricles contract at just a little bit later time. That's really handy because the atria are going to help fill the ventricles up with blood before they contract. All right. The atria aren't really important. Right? You can live just a nice normal life if the atria don't contract because they hardly contract at all. If you watch my hand, I can show you how an atrium contracts. Right? See my hand right here? It's not moving right now. An atrium, when it contracts, is going to look like this. Did you see my hand move? just a little bit, right? That's how an atrium contracts. You want to see how a ventricle contracts? Boom, boom. Okay, was that stronger or the same or weaker? A lot stronger, a lot stronger. Okay, so the atria just help fill up these ventricles with blood. And you should know all the other pieces of the heart, like all the chambers, all the valves. And the only valve I can't see is the, which can't I see? The pulmonary semilunar valve, because we had to make a nice, what kind of section is this through the heart, do you think? More like a coronal plane, right, through the heart. Okay. Well, you know that sometimes when you overwork a skeletal muscle, or your electrolyte imbalance is off, maybe you're dehydrated a little bit, a skeletal muscle can go into spasm, right? And it just stays contracted. And sometimes you call that a muscle cramp or Charlie horse. Has anybody ever had a muscle spasm in a skeletal muscle in their body anyplace? Probably everybody, right? Like if I get a spasm in my biceps right here, it just becomes contracted. And then I walk around and show everybody how big and powerful this biceps muscle is with a big smile on my face. Is that what would happen? No. What would happen? It's very painful, right? And you would do anything to get that muscle to relax. Do something with your other arm, skip around, do something to get that muscle to relax. Because how does it hurt? Hurts like hell, right? Hurts really, really bad. Okay. Well, fortunately, the heart, because it's a different kind of muscle, it cannot go into spasm, right? With that spasm, we call tetanus, right? So a heart can never become contracted. And why is that, and stay contracted, and why is that so great? Because when it's contracted and doesn't relax, it can never pump blood, right? And remember, if the heart's not pumping blood, you have about 2 to 3 seconds worth of consciousness, and then after 2 to 3 minutes, what happens to your brain? It actually dies, right? And so there are some special properties that you're going to look at in physiology classes that prevent heart muscle from going into tetanus, unlike skeletal muscle. It's just a special muscle that way, and we're really glad that it is that way. Okay, so this SA node is controlled by a nervous system that shows precise control and balance. All right, what kind of control system shows precise control and balance? And it's called, it's got to have two divisions, and they got to be antagonistic to each other, right? Okay, yeah, so the autonomic nervous system controls this SA node, but you know, how many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? It's got two. Can you remember their names? Yeah, sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's the relationship between them? Antagonistic, right? So you could think of them as being the gas pedal and brake pedal that controls this SA node right here so that it has precise control, and that controls how fast the heart beats. And something that can adjust how fast the heart beats or the heart rate of the heart, we call that a chronotropic effect. Chrono means time. Right, so anything that can affect heart rate can affect the chronotropy of the heart. Right, but there's something else that determines how much blood the heart can pump and what kind of blood pressure the heart can develop, and that is not just how fast it beats, but how strong it beats as well. Right, those are two independent ideas. And if something adjusts the strength of contraction, we don't call it a chronotropic effect, we call it an inotropic effect. So inotropy has to do with strength of contraction. Chronotropy has to do with the rate of contraction. And both of those things are controlled. Very important to maintain blood pressure and the health inside your body, right? Inotropy and chronotropy. So it'd be good if you can remember those things before you get into the physiology class. We'll be really interested in those two effects when we look at the heart. Okay, well, now I want to go back. I didn't turn the lights off yet. All right, remember I told you how important this figure was? What figure is that? 19.1 shows you all the valves. They're not labeled. All the chambers, they're not labeled. All the vessels, great vessels. Great vessels coming off where? the base of the heart. Yeah, the great cardiac vessels coming off the base of the heart. Okay, and a pre-lecture reading assignment was trace a drop of blood through the systemic and pulmonary circulation, including all chambers, all valves, and tell me what the state of blood is in each of these locations. All right, so I want to do that right now, but I want to do it on the board, so that's why I didn't turn the lights off. I'm going to erase some of this. I'm going to change topics with you for just a second because I want to ask you, what is the most anterior great vessel coming off the base of the heart? Pulmonary trunk. Right. Okay. Sorry, I just kind of beat that into you, but that's so important to remember. All right, so we're going to trace a drop of blood through the circulation. And where would you like to start? Or does somebody want to come up to the board and draw it? Anybody want to draw that? Write it out? We're not going to draw. We're just words, right? Nobody's going to do it. Okay, but where should we start? Where should we put a drop of blood and then follow it around?
Right atrium.
Right atrium. That's a really good place to start. Right atrium. So if you want to look at the figure, that's okay with me, but eventually I want you to have this all in your mind to where you don't have to look at a figure because you'll be talking to people about this stuff and you won't even have time to think about a figure. You're just going to have to know, right? So looking at this figure is a good step. Having it in your mind is another, but eventually you're just going to use it like a language. You know, English you don't think about before you speak a word probably most times, okay? All right, so we're going to start in the right atrium. I'm going to abbreviate right with just an R, and atrium, all right, and it's on the right side of the heart. All right, so now where is blood going to go from the right atrium? Right ventricle, guess what? Okay, we skipped something really important already. So the tricuspid valve, exactly. All right, so I'm going to put tricuspid valve. And you should probably know a general name for a tricuspid valve, something that the bicuspid and tricuspid both, you could use that term for both of them. Yeah, they're called AV valves or atrioventricular valves because they're right between an atrium and a ventricle. I don't want to draw it in, but draw it in on your piece of paper. Okay. All right, so what's the state of blood here in the right atrium? High or low in oxygen? Low in oxygen. So I'm going to put a little down arrow. All right, so here is oxygen. It's going to be low in oxygen. What about at the tricuspid valve? Low in oxygen. Nice. Okay. Then after the tricuspid valve, where does it go?
Right ventricle.
And what's the condition of this blood? Low in oxygen. All right, and then from the right ventricle, where does it go? Okay, think. The pulmonary valve. Yeah, because we've got to think of these valves, right? So pulmonary. And it's a semilunar valve. Maybe you want to jot that down. I won't write it on the board just for space reasons. Now, what's the state of blood as it's going by pulmonary? Low in oxygen. Okay, and then where does it go? Pulmonary trunk, and you should think of the trunk as an artery or a vein. Artery, right. So I'm going to say pulmonary trunk, but of course you should know that's an artery. And what's the state of blood in this artery? Are you sure? Yeah, okay. Okay. Low in oxygen. Do all arteries? Are all arteries low in oxygen? No. Okay. Oh, that's why I'm getting confused, because this is the pulmonary circulation, right? It's kind of special. All right. So here is an artery that's low in oxygen. Then where does this blood go from the pulmonary trunk? Okay. And in capillaries? Perfect. But what organ are those capillaries in? Here's the key, pulmonary. What does pulmonary mean? Lungs. So capillaries. Pulmonary capillaries. But you know what pulmonary means, right? Pulmonary capillary.
All right, now here is a
these are special. What can happen in a capillary? Yeah, exchange. They're really thin. We're going to see in the next chapter that capillaries are so thin, things can enter the blood or could leave the blood, and they can only do it in a capillary because arteries and veins are way too thick. All right, so I'm not going to say neither high or low in oxygen. I'm just going to put exchange takes place. Okay, what kind of blood vessel does exchange take place in?
A capillary.
All right, and it's exchanging. What does that mean? That means O2 goes in the blood, and at the same time, there's something that's going to leave the blood, because we didn't really draw it here, but so I'll draw it right here. A lot of CO2, all right? So then CO2 goes which way? Goes out, right? So these switch places. All right, so now, where does blood go after this pulmonary capillary? I like that. Now, where do I want to put this vein? Maybe I'll just kind of draw it right up over here. Okay. And, oh, what kind of, you said vein. Yeah, I like vein. What kind?
Pulmonary vein.
So this is still has to do with the lungs, because you see pulmonary, and it's a vein, so what about oxygen in this vein? It's high, right?
That's strange, but you are exactly right. So here's a vein that's high in oxygen, and then of course what? Low in CO2, because it's coming back from the lungs.
Pulmonary vein, where does that go to? The left atrium,
abbreviated right here. Atrium. Now what about the state of oxygen in this left atrium? It's high, right? Same thing for CO2.
Left atrium, where does it go? Bicuspid valve.
And notice I put mitral valve, but of course you know that's the bicuspid valve.
What about oxygen? High. I'm just going to put a little IBID sign right there just to carry that down.
Mitral valve goes to, blood passes into the left ventricle. What's the state of blood right there?
High, because there are no capillaries, nothing can happen to the oxygen that's in that blood, can't go anywhere, it's trapped. Left ventricle, then it goes, left ventricle. Where's the left ventricle going to pump blood? Okay. It's going to pump it into the aorta, but it's got to go through the aortic valve first, right?
Okay. So, aortic. And remember, that's semilunar valve. And that oxygen couldn't leave because there's no exchange taking place, so it's still high in oxygen. And then from the aorta, where does that...
Oh, from the aortic semilunar valve, then where does it go?
Aorta. Aorta, right? And what kind of blood vessel is an aorta, artery or vein?
Artery.
Nobody ever says aorta artery, but because everybody knows that, right? But it is an artery.
And after the aorta artery, where does it go? It's everywhere in the body, right? Where exchange is going to take place. So what kind of blood vessel is exchange going to take place in?
Capillary.
All right, now it can't be pulmonary capillaries. We're going to call these all over your body, except your lungs, that is systemic capillaries, right? Oh, in the aorta, don't forget, high in oxygen. Now what about systemic capillaries?
Exchange. All right, so we're going to put exchange right here. A little bit different than in the lungs, because where does O2 go? Yeah, O2 goes out. That sounds terrible, but that's okay. But it's going to your body, so that's good, right? You're going to use it. And what about CO2? CO2 goes in. So you can get rid of it from your body, because that's just a waste product, and it can be toxic.
Okay, after systemic capillaries, where does it go? Okay. Systemic capillaries,
Okay, it's going to end up in the right atrium, I agree, but how's it going to get there? It's got to get there. Yeah, somebody said a vein. Nice, right? So systemic capillaries, and I'm just going to kind of draw it. Okay, systemic capillaries. I didn't leave myself enough room on the board, but that's okay because I'll draw it right here. We have what? Like the superior / maybe inferior vena cava. And vena, what does vena cava mean? Cavern, a big cavernous vein. And then, so what's the state of blood here in the vena cava? Right? Low O2, high CO2, which matches up with the blood in the right atrium, and then we've completed the whole circuit. All right. Well, there's a pattern here. I didn't draw exactly well, okay, but there, the scheme, no matter if it's the right side of the heart or the left side of the heart, okay, there's a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart. And what are we going to call that kind of blood vessel every single time? That's an artery. Can an artery be low in oxygen? Yeah, where's low? Ah, pulmonary artery, low in oxygen. All right, so arteries are low in oxygen in what kind of circulation? The pulmonary circulation. Can an artery ever be high in oxygen? Yeah, in the systemic circulation, right? High in oxygen. So remember, the pulmonary and systemic kind of are backwards. Okay. So the usual circulation here is the nice diagram of a heart. We got something taking blood away. This is what? An artery. Doesn't matter if it's high in oxygen or low in oxygen. Right? And then it goes to another vascular element that we call a. And things can go in, things can go out. That's a capillary. And from a capillary, goes back to the heart, and this vessel is always going to be called a vein. Right? So remember, artery is determined only by the direction of blood flow, not what kind of blood is in there. A vein is defined by the direction of blood flow, not by its contents. So sometimes that can be hard to see, but I hope you see it. Okay? Anybody do this in their pre-lecture reading assignments? Sort of? You got to do it. And here is, what, that perfect figure, figure 19.1, that shows everything that we've done here. All right, so make sure you can put this into words. All right, so that's it for the heart chapter. Unless somebody's got a question. Somebody got a question on the heart? All right. Now I can turn some lights off, like this, and like this, and like that, and like that. Yeah, nice. All right, so what's next? Blood vessels. We talked about blood vessels a little bit already, so that's okay. I'll put that away, put that away. Open up some blood vessels. Put this over here. Okay, so we can look at the text slide in just a little bit. I'll leave it showing, but what I want to look at, okay, is the illustration, 20.1b. This is a really nice illustration because it shows in some detail what we were just talking about, a nice circuit of blood flow. And we could maybe think of this from the left ventricle. That would be fine. So here I see some arrows moving in this direction. This is labeled an artery. So where would you put the heart? Would you put it down here or would you put it up on top by looking at the direction of these arrows? On the top, that's right, because that's taking blood away from the heart, that's an artery. And then after an artery, where does blood go? Capillary for exchange, and then blood goes into a vein, and it goes back to the heart. So this is the usual circulation. There are a couple interesting exceptions to this rule, which I'll point out, but this is a good place to start. And when you look at this figure, right, when you look at the cross-section of an artery, cross-section of a capillary, and cross-section of a vein, right, can you see that there is a difference between capillary and artery? Capillary and vein. What's the difference that you see? Okay.
Some people probably had some good ideas, but I couldn't quite hear. Layers. Yeah, one word, layers. Look how thick this artery is. Right? And even look how thick a vein is compared to this really thin capillary. Right? So here is a tube. Here are some cells that line a tube. Do you remember what kind of tissue lines a tube? An epithelium, right? And can you classify this epithelium for me? How many layers? I see one layer. And this is just connective tissue. I don't see any cells in there. But here are the cells. So I see one layer that's a simple epithelium. Okay, and the shape of these cells are squamous. So that simple squamous epithelium that lines this capillary, we call that an endothelium. And that endothelium actually lines arteries and veins as well. But in a capillary, that's the only layer besides some connective tissue. Okay? So that's why exchange can take place, because this wall is really thin. And there's some other specializations in this wall that we'll look at the end of the chapter. Okay. Well, here is an artery. Arteries are very thick, they're very strong, because they contain blood at a very high pressure. And that blood would just bust through this blood vessel unless it was very strong. So what are some of these layers? Well, here's that endothelium. This is the innermost layer. That innermost layer, we call that the tunica intima. And the tunica intima also has some connective tissue, the subendothelial layer. And then here's something pretty cool. It's got some elastic tissue. Gosh, what does that mean? That elastic tissue. Yeah, it can stretch. It's really nice. So when the heart beats, it pumps a whole bunch of blood into this vessel, and it kind of blows up like a balloon. But remember, the heart can't stay contracted. What does it have to do? It's got to relax, right? And when it relaxes, the blood pressure would start to drop, but because that energy was stored in expanding that blood vessel, that elasticity then can keep blood flowing through these arteries because of this internal elastic membrane of the tunica intima. All right, but this elastic layer is not super strong. It can just stretch a little bit and then go back to its normal position. Since there's really high pressure, there has to be some very strong muscle surrounding this artery, and that's the tunica intima. And what kind of muscle do you think this is? Yeah, can you remember there's three kinds of muscle, and this particular one, involuntary, you can't control if it contracts or not. Right? And so this is the tunica media, and it's a big, thick layer of muscle so that this vessel doesn't rip open. And if there's something wrong with this blood vessel, it can. Right? And so this is the reason why we're interested in all of these different layers, because when a blood vessel becomes damaged or diseased, we need to be able to understand all these different layers and what's happening. All right. Also within the tunica media is another elastic layer, and then that takes us to the outermost layer, that's the tunica externa, right? And you can see that it has collagen fibers. And what do you know about collagen fibers? They're super strong, right? And so that maintains the integrity of this very high-pressure blood vessel. And so those are the layers. Veins have the same layers, but they're missing the elastic properties, because by the time blood gets into a vein, it's no longer pulsatile. It never goes high and low, right? It's just constantly flowing. And there's something else that's different. Look at this endothelial layer. What do you see right in the lumen of this vein? It's a valve. That's right. So when the blood is moving back toward the heart, these little leaflets open up, allows blood to flow past. When it starts to flow backwards, like it tries to do all the time, then these valves come together and prevents that backward flow of blood. That backward flow is what we call retrograde flow. Right? So blood should be going back to the heart, not back down to your extremities. Right, and these valves work as long as the diameter of this vein, right, is healthy. Right, if veins dilate, and that happens sometimes, then this vein can be so large that the valves can't touch each other. They'll just flop back and forth, and blood will be going back and forth. Right, and maybe you've noticed that in people sometimes when they have varicose veins. Veins are really big. Blood has a tendency to pool. You can see the pooling of blood primarily in their legs. And that can be a really dangerous circumstance, especially if some deeper veins are involved. We call that Well, I'll tell you what that is in a second. When blood stops flowing, guess what it likes to do? When it's flowing, it's a liquid. When it stops flowing, guess what it likes to do? It likes to form a solid, likes to form a plug or a thrombosis, and then it can't flow, right? Or maybe a piece can break off and can go to your brain and cause a stroke, or go to your heart, cause a heart attack, or go to your lungs and plug up blood vessels in your lungs. If your lungs are plugged up, what can't happen? Exchange can't happen, right? We call that pulmonary embolism. All of those routinely are fatal, right? So never want that to happen. All right, so if there are deep veins inside the body, we call that deep vein thrombosis. That has to be diagnosed and treated with something that will decrease blood clotting function, so blood doesn't clot in these veins that are way too dilated. Okay, so what I know right now, I know some valves in the cardiovascular system. What about an artery? Does an artery have valves? No. What about capillary? No. What about veins? Yes. What else? What about this heart up over here? Yes, heart has valves as well. So far, the heart has valves and veins have valves to prevent retrograde flow of blood. So sometimes, see, we have a nice big large artery. Sometimes we call this little branch off of the artery. This is a microscopic branch. This is drawn very large so that we can see it. We call this an arteriole. Then we have a capillary, right, just like this. And then we have a venule. A venule is a small vein. An arteriole is a small artery. All right, so that's pretty good to understand that. So here are the three layers, externa, media, intima, and some description of what's going on in these layers. And it's really important to know these layers because this is where we can diagnose disease in blood vessels. And there is a place in the human body that is imaged more frequently than any other location. I think that's true. That is, I'll say it's true, but it might not be exactly true, but I would guess it's exactly true. There are departments in hospitals in the ultrasound region, and they're taking images all day long of, anybody know where they're really interested in looking all the time? Hundreds of patients go through their arteries, and in particular, one in the neck, right? They're imaged so that they can tell what's going on with these different layers, right? And then they can make some really nice diagnoses as to why somebody is having a stroke or transient ischemic attacks or other kinds of things. They can determine the health of that particular region, which we're going to learn about in just a second, okay? And also vessels all over the body. Okay, so an artery takes blood away from the heart, okay? And, of course, it may be oxygenated or deoxygenated, right? And it's the highest pressure, and it has some elastic layers and large arteries that are close to the heart. We call these conducting arteries. There are other kinds of arteries that are far away from the heart. So an artery far away from the heart, is that proximal or distal? Distal, yeah, so distal arteries, right, have less elasticity in them, and we call those distributing arteries. So conducting arteries are more elastic than distributing arteries, so the layer is just a little bit different. And because there's smooth muscle around these arteries, what can they do? What makes your iris? What kind of muscle makes up your iris? Smooth muscle. And what can your iris do? It can dilate to let a lot of light in, or it can constrict to let less light in, depending on ambient light conditions. And that's exactly the function, one of the functions of this smooth muscle here. Not only does it make the artery strong, right, it can also contract, causing contraction or dilation. And the same thing for these arterioles as well. So that's hugely important. Because of a law of physics, doesn't really have anything to do with physiology, but it's just a law of physics. And that law of physics just says that small changes in the radius of a blood vessel causes huge differences in the amount of flow that can go through that tube. All right, so if we, let's take a look. So if we look at the radius of a tube, and let's just say it's 1, and measure the blood flow through it, and we see that we're just going to call that 1, right? So at this radius, you get a a unit of blood flow. And if we double the radius, right, I see two up over here, what would you expect? Maybe a doubling in blood flow, right? If you double the size of an artery, you would double the amount of blood that can flow through it. But take a look at the number underneath the two. What do you see? Is it a 2? No, it is a 16. So if you double the size of a blood vessel, then you have 16 times as much blood flowing through it. That's fantastic, right? We call that the fourth power rule, right? So when we double the radius, you have to multiply 2 by itself 4 times. So 2 times 2 is 4, times 2 is 8, times 2 is 16, right? And so as a matter of fact, if you increase the diameter of a blood vessel 4 times, what does that turn out to be? 256 times the amount of blood flow going through there. So that's a huge difference. So blood flow through your body can be regulated very efficiently just by changing the diameter of blood vessels, right? And part of that is done with your autonomic nervous system. Okay, so that's a really important rule, especially when you get into physiology. Okay, there's one thing that I didn't see right here. Oh, yeah. This is good. All right, so you see an artery, correct, on this slide. This is, what, 20.4? And the heart would be below it. Somehow they changed the arrows on this, right? So here you have an artery because it's red, then a nice capillary network, and now a vein taking blood back to the heart. And do you see these structures? Right at the entrance to a capillary bed. I see one here, I see one here, and I see one here, here, and here. These are special smooth muscles, and it acts like a, I would maybe say a valve, but a gate is probably a better way to talk about these. These things can contract and cause constriction, and that greatly reduces the flow, right, according to that fourth power rule, into this capillary. This thing we call a pre-capillary sphincter. A circular smooth muscle, right, that acts as a gate is what we call a sphincter. We're going to look at some other sphincters. Remember, a circular skeletal muscle is always called an orbicularis, usually, like orbicularis oculi and oris, right? But this one's a little bit different. Okay, so these are precapillary sphincters, and these determine how much blood flows into this capillary. So under this condition that I see on the top, I would say that this is going to a muscle that is active. So if a muscle is active, it is using up oxygen, producing CO2, using up nutrients, and producing other kinds of waste products. And as a result of those chemicals in this neighborhood, these precapillary sphincters will dilate and allow blood to flow in. Right? To what? Bring in oxygen, get rid of CO2. It would be a nice way to think about that. If we look at the bottom case, guess what? These sphincters look contracted to me. Why do they look contracted? Because I don't see any blood flow going through the capillary. It goes straight through. Right? So we call this sometimes a thoroughfare channel. It's not going through the capillary. And I know that this particular muscle now is relaxed. It's not contracting. There is high oxygen in this area because the muscle isn't using it up. There isn't CO2. Muscle isn't producing CO2 because it's not contracting. And all the nutrients are at a good level because the muscle cells aren't using it up and the muscles aren't secreting any byproducts. They're not building up in this space either. All of those things control this sphincter. So these precapillary sphincters can adjust the blood flow through this capillary bed based on the needs of the tissue that this capillary bed is supplying. So that's pretty important. We call that local control. Probably you don't have to know what it's called in this class. Okay. So these capillaries can take different forms depending on where they are located in the body. So let's see if I can show you some of these different... Oh, it's exactly the next picture. Okay. Here it is. So here's a capillary. How could you tell me this is a capillary? What could you recognize? A simple squamous endothelium that's lining this blood vessel. No muscle layers, no elastic layers, no connective tissue layers. Okay. All right, so here is what we call a continuous capillary. But even in a... And I see a nice red blood cell right? The diameter of this capillary is about the size of this red blood cell, really, really small. And so notice that the endothelium is not exactly continuous all the way around. In between cells, right, there are intercellular clefts. And what does that intercellular cleft allow? It allows for fluid to leak out of the capillary. Not red blood cells, right? This red blood cell is way too big to leak out. Big protein molecules can't leak out because they're too big. But small molecules that are dissolved in fluid or plasma can leak out and surround and nourish all the cells in this area. All right, so these things, intercellular clefts, right? This is what we call a continuous capillary. This is the usual kind of capillary, and it's the least permeable, right? The least permeable kind. So we got to look at some that are more leaky or more permeable. The next kind is what we call a fenestrated capillary. So continuous was the first one. Fenestrated is a little bit more leaky. Fenestration, fenestra usually means like a window, right? So there are like holes in these cells. So here we see the cells that make up the endothelium. And you still have those intercellular clefts, these spaces between the cells. But now you've got something else. You have pores that go all the way through the cells of that make up the endothelium, right? Intercellular clefts, fenestrations or pores. And so now this capillary, because it has all these extra holes, is more permeable. So there's some parts of your body where you want a capillary to be more leaky than a continuous capillary. Well, you might be worried that you're losing too much fluid just by sitting here taking notes because of these fenestrated capillaries. Right? Well, it gets worse. There's another kind of capillary. Look at this one here. And this one is not diseased. This is a normal one. This is what we call a sinusoidal capillary. And look at the intercellular clefts. They're huge, right? And the fenestrations are huge as well. And then there's even discontinuous coverage of the connective tissue sheath that surrounds the capillary. So this kind of capillary is what? Very leaky. And we're going to find these in liver and spleen and bone marrow. So these organs need to have sinusoidal capillaries. So a lot of stuff leaves the blood, then it's processed, and then it's returned back to the blood. That's pretty much what the job of the liver and the spleen is. It's a special filtration system. All right, so you see the three kinds of capillaries: continuous, fenestrated, and sinusoidal. And that's in the order of how leaky they are. What about veins? We talked about veins already. Okay, that's pretty good. One thing I want to tell you, a little, some more physics. Let's go talk about some more physics a little bit. And I want to go back to this figure from the previous chapter, 19.1. And you can see an artery, you can see a capillary, and a vein. Right? And the physics of this blood flow is that blood flow will move sort of like how molecules move by diffusion. We didn't spend a whole lot of time in diffusion in here, but does anybody remember how a molecule can just move all by itself? Like if I open up a perfume bottle right here, eventually somebody in the front row will smell it, then the second row, third, all the way back, you know, in a couple hours, all the way in the back. What's that process called where that perfume molecule moves? Diffusion, yeah. And how does diffusion go? Why does it work? The concentration gradient. Right around the bottle, there's a lot of perfume molecules. In the back of the room, there's zero. So that perfume is just going to move from where it's very concentrated to where it's a low concentration. All right, so a concentration gradient. So what happens if the concentration of perfume in the air in the front is exactly the same as the back? Like if we come back after a weekend, we leave the perfume bottle open all weekend. Right? What happens to diffusion when you can smell the perfume just as strong in the back of the room as down over here in the front? It stops because the concentration gradient has gone to zero. Right? If the concentration gradient is zero, diffusion stops. And how does it always go from high to low? All right. Well, a fluid like blood will move, will flow according to pressure. That's what determines blood flow, is pressure. And just like diffusion, How will blood move according to pressure? From high pressure to low pressure. What happens if the pressure is the same? Blood won't have a reason to flow, right? There won't be a force. Okay, so here we see some blood flow through the cardiovascular systems, both the pulmonary and systemic circulation. And here we have a vein and a capillary and an artery. Which one has the lowest pressure? Can you see which one has the lowest pressure? I hear the correct answer a couple times. Sometimes I don't hear the correct answer. I talk to a lot of students and they say a capillary has the lowest pressure, right? Because functionally that's really important because that's where exchange takes place, right? But you know what? If capillaries had the lowest pressure, which way would blood flow? From an artery into a capillary and a vein into a capillary. Blood would never get back to the heart. So what has to have the lowest blood pressure? Vein, capillary, or artery? Veins have to have the lowest pressure. That's exactly right. All right, so that's really what I wanted to show you on this text slide. Right, so veins may be oxygenated or deoxygenated. They have the lowest blood pressure, so that blood flows back into them. And since it has very low pressure, then it's really hard for blood to get back to the heart, and that's why it has valves, to make sure that it doesn't go back down into the periphery. And this last point right here, one of the reasons why blood flows back to the heart is because surrounding this vein, you have skeletal muscle. And when you contract that skeletal muscle, watch, it bulges up, right? And it squishes this vein. It pressurizes this vein whenever you use a muscle that it's going through. And which way is that blood going to squirt when it gets pressure? It's just going to be squeezed, like somebody grabbed it with their hands and squeezes down on it. So it develops some pressure in this region. Which way is blood going to flow? To the capillary or to the heart? And why? Fortunately, it's going to go back to the heart, not down to this capillary. And why is that? Because what do these capillaries have? What do those veins have? Valves right here. That's right. So you squeeze a little segment of this vein because a skeletal muscle contracts. That's going to help squirt blood back up to the heart. That's really important. All right, so physical activity is really important to get blood moving back to your heart. If you're sedentary for hours and hours and hours, that blood is going to pool, right, in veins. What is one possible scenario when you're not exercising skeletal muscle, it's not flowing back to your heart, and it pools? What's one possible outcome of that? When blood stops flowing, it likes to form a clot. That's right. And, you know, that happens sometimes to people when they get on an airplane and fly from New York City to Hong Kong or L.A. to Denpasar or someplace, right? And when that blood clot moves, it goes into the right atrium, right ventricle, and then where's the next capillary that it bumps into after leaving the right ventricle? Oh, it's right here on the board. It is where? It's your lungs, right? And since those capillaries are really small, that blood clot then blocks up maybe an arterial or some capillaries in your lungs. We call that pulmonary embolism, right? Pulmonary embolism. And I don't know how often that's fatal, but commonly fatal. I don't know if I want to say usually, but maybe it is usually fatal. Okay, very serious condition. Okay, so that's what we call the skeletal muscle pump, or respiratory pump. That's how blood gets back to your heart sometimes. Okay, so how many sides does your heart have once again? Nice. How many circulations are there in your body? And what are they called? Yeah, pulmonary and systemic, or systemic and pulmonary. So here is what you have to know about the pulmonary circulation from this particular chapter, and that is the pulmonary trunk. Right, which is connected to the right ventricle. And that pulmonary trunk, it's an artery, right, because it's taking blood away from the heart. Is it high in O2 or low in O2? The pulmonary trunk. High or low in oxygen? Low, because it's going to the lungs, remember, to pick up oxygen. That's what it says right here. The pulmonary trunk bifurcates very soon into the right and left pulmonary artery, going to the right and left lung. Right, and then you get the lung capillaries for exchange. We wrote that on the board. And then there are actually four pulmonary veins,
that bring blood back from the lungs, two from the right lung, two from the left lung, and there are four pulmonary veins that attach to the, what part of the heart do they attach to, the pulmonary veins? Yeah, an atrium. I like that. Which one? The one on the left. Yeah, the left atrium. And that's what it says right here in your notes.
I don't know who made these notes, but so far they look okay. All right, so that's the systemic circulation. And, I mean, pulmonary circulation. And then we got to move on to systemic circulation.
We're going to look at some pictures here, I think, pretty soon. Oh, I do have a nice, oh, here's that nice skeletal muscle pump, right? When these skeletal muscles contract, it pressurizes blood in this area. It can't go back to the periphery because of this valve, but it can squirt back up to the heart. That's really nice. All right, so what do we got right here? What circulation is this? Pulmonary circulation, right? So here's the right ventricle pumping blood through the pulmonary semilunar valve into the pulmonary trunk, which then bifurcates into the right and left pulmonary artery. And where does that right pulmonary artery go? Check this out. Where it's tucked right under what? The aorta. Yeah, it's tucked right underneath the aorta, right? And it goes to the right lung. All right, so I'm looking in the lung right now, and I see this nice blue vessel right here in the lung. Is this an artery or a vein? Artery or a vein? You got to know this. If you don't, you're going to miss it on the practicum. This is a pulmonary artery, right? Because arteries in the pulmonary circulation are colored blue, low in oxygen. And if I point to this one over here, this red one, this is what? It's a pulmonary vein, right? Because what has happened between this artery and vein? We see it right over here. Exchange is taking place in this pulmonary capillary. All right, so here is the whole pulmonary circulation. Sweet. What do we got right here? The arterial systemic circulation. So here are some things you got to know about the systemic circulation. It starts with the aorta. I want to see if I have a better picture of just the aorta. Maybe I have to go back. Yeah, let's take a look at this heart. Okay, so here is the left ventricle. You could consider this maybe the start of the systemic circulation, pumping blood past the aortic semilunar valve into the, what part of the aorta is this? This is the ascending aorta, and then the arch of the aorta, and then it curves back inferiorly, and too bad you can't see a little piece of the descending aorta. Right? It's posterior to the heart, so we can't see it on this illustration, unless we could kind of turn it around. So that's the aorta. Before we get down to the thoracic and abdominal divisions of the aorta, those are the descending, there are some branches that you should be aware of that come off the aorta, bringing oxygenated blood to various parts of your body. And I can see the first branch. There are two of them. I've mentioned this before. They're really hard to see on this diagram. I see some that are really easy to see. But what are the first branches coming off the aorta? Delivering oxygen to your heart. They are the coronary arteries. And there's a right and left one. So remember, what ventricle is over here? Left, and here is the right. Right. Here's that nice anterior longitudinal sulcus. And I see a nice red vessel right here. This is the left coronary artery. And over here is the right coronary artery. They come off of the ascending aorta. I can't see where they come off. I can just see them lying on the surface of the heart. All right, so ascending aorta has branches. The arch has branches. Do you see the branches? I see over here to the right side of the body the brachiocephalic. Brachio means arm, cephalic means toward the head. So this is going to take blood to the head and arm on what side of your body? The right side. Right. And then the next two are a common carotid and a subclavian. And if you add these two vessels together, where are they going to bring blood to? Your head and your arm, right? So these two are like doing the job of the brachiocephalic, but on the left side of the body. Nice. All right, so that's off the branches off the arch of the aorta. Is that what we have right here? Yeah. Okay.
Well, what's nice, let's go back to the brachiocephalic artery. We don't have to say right or left. Does anybody have an idea why we don't have to say right or left brachiocephalic? Excuse me. Yeah, because there's only one. So you can't say right or left because there's only one. So here's brachiocephalic. I see it bifurcating right here. And it bifurcates into the subclavian, the right subclavian, and the right common carotid, just like what we had over here on these branches, right? So there really is some symmetry, even though it looks a little weird. Okay, so that's that on the heart. Let me continue. Oh, good. It was the very next figure. All right, so do you see brachiocephalic? It bifurcates into what? The subclavian. Oh, where does that subclavian go? Why do we call it subclavian? Underneath the clavicle, right? And the clavicle's got that special shape, so when it breaks, frequently does, doesn't break into the subclavian artery because that would probably be fatal almost immediately. It breaks what? Clavicle breaks anteriorly, protects this nice blood vessel. All right, so brachiocephalic bifurcates into a subclavian, and here is what I call the common carotid artery, bringing blood to the head. And still got a couple minutes left. Here is another bifurcation. Remember, what is a bifurcation again? It's a splitting, yeah, in of a blood vessel taking blood away from the heart, right, to a blood vessel that is going to take blood to places outside of your cranium, right, like on the surface of your skull and to your face muscles, and an internal carotid artery, which is going to bring blood to your brain. Is that an important one, this internal carotid right here? Indeed it is. Now look at this junction. It looks kind of funny. Do you see like a little bulge right here? Looks kind of funny. Doesn't look nice and smooth like this. This is, and it's not labeled on this figure. It really should be. Maybe one of the biggest omissions in your textbook. This is what we call the carotid sinus. Carotid sinus. And this is the area that is diseased in a lot of people, and it starts to dilate, and it gets very brittle, it can fracture, and it can generate thrombus that move, and if this carotid sinus produces a thrombus, where is it going to go? Right to the brain. What does that cause? Stroke. That causes a stroke. Yeah, it's like a, it's sort of like a heart attack, except it's a brain attack. Right, a stroke is a brain attack. And good luck with that. It doesn't always mean your brain is going to die, but some part is probably going to die. All right, and so that's why this carotid sinus is imaged so frequently to understand what is happening in this area, and that's because of the shape of these blood vessels, right, when they bifurcate. All right, that's good for now. Here's that subclavian. There's a second branch. Oh, here's the subclavian. The first branch of the subclavian, look where it goes. It's ascending into the brain as well, but do you see it passing through these vertebrae? Yeah. Now, what do we call these holes in the vertebrae? The vertebral foramina, right? Transverse foramina. So this is the vertebral artery. So there are only two blood vessels that bring blood to the brain. The vertebral arteries that I see right here and the internal carotid artery. All right, just these two. Too bad we don't have more because it's really important to get all that blood up to the brain. All right, so that's all I want you to know from this particular figure. I don't think you have to know many of these other arteries. Look at your text, your notes, to know exactly what arteries you have to know. Okay, so you see all these asterisks right here? That represents that these are the arteries that bring blood to the brain. All right, the internal carotid and the vertebral artery. And I think next time we'll finish up some arteries by finishing tracing blood through this subclavian down through the arm, and then we got to look at the descending aorta through the abdominal region, and then look at some circulation in the legs, and then a super special circulation, the hepatic portal system. And next time we'll have to see why that's so special. It's a special circulatory system. It disobeys that rule of artery, capillary, vein.
It has a different arrangement. It has an artery, capillary, another vessel, second capillary, and then a vein to the heart. It's got two capillary beds. All right, so the sign-in sheet is going around, and I promised to get this lecture online. I didn't get Wednesday's lecture online, but I'll try and get it up there fast. Okay.